Please, Mr. Warehouser, I don't want to go. The earth is shaking underfoot, St. Helens gonna blow. Please, Mr. Warehouser, I don't want to go. The ash is in the rigging, and the mud is gonna flow.
Hadn't heard that one.
Yeah, that's a rarity.
Later this spring, May 18th, in fact, the Northwest will mark the 40th anniversary of the eruption of Mount St. Helens. And a museum in Spokane has kicked things off with a new exhibit, plus an online effort to collect memories. And, of course, our resident historian Felix Bunnell, who was once an 11-year-old volcano enthusiast, is here to tell us all about it. Brought to you by the King County Library System.
Yeah, speaking from personal experience, 1980 really was a terrific time to be an 11-year-old in the Northwest. And the 40th anniversary of that May 18th eruption, it's a real milestone. You know, working on history projects like this the last 25 years, I found the 40th is a real sweet spot for commemorating events. You know, it's long enough ago that it really feels like history, and the traumatic parts, you know, the fact that 57 people died in that eruption, those traumatic parts are not as traumatic. And 40 years is recent enough that significant numbers of people are still alive who remember it. That second part was really true. We marked the 40th anniversary of the World's Fair back in 2002. 10 years later for the 50th, so many people had passed on in that decade. So this is a really important year. So I was thrilled to visit the Northwest Museum of Arts and Culture. It's the MAC over in Spokane a few days ago, and toured two new exhibits there. One's about Pompeii, the city in Italy that was wiped out by Vesuvius back in 79 AD. We didn't cover that here at Cairo.
No.
The other's about Mount St. Helens. Now, those disasters have their similarities. But MAC curator Freya Liggett says there was only one person who wrote about what happened at Pompeii, the Roman figure known as Pliny the Younger.
This Pompeii story has a lot of its human element came to us through that one written record. Whereas Mount St. Helens, we have tens of thousands of experiences, and you know that's what we're attempting to capture now. And kind of see, like, what is the value of that 2,000 years from now? What will those experiences be like for exploring Pacific Northwest history?
And so the show at the MAC is called Mount St. Helens Critical Memory 40 Years Later. It's packed with social and cultural memories of Mount St. Helens from people all over Washington State. You can almost call it sort of volcano pop culture. There's jars of ash collected by just regular people, commercially made souvenirs, terrific photos of people like USGS scientist David Johnson, and perhaps my very favorite Northwest person of all time, Spirit Lake Lodge owner Harry Truman.
I lived up there 50 years. I had some people yesterday ask me why the hell I stay there and what I'm doing up there. That's my life. Spirit Lake and Mount St. Helens is my life, folks. I've lived there 50 years. It's a part of me. That mountain and that lake is a part of Truman, and I'm a part of it.
You know, that guy is just mythic. He famously refused to leave in spite of the danger, and he ultimately perished in the eruption. And I didn't get that as an 11-year-old, but I totally get it now. I wouldn't leave Spirit Lake Lodge either. But in honor of Harry Truman, the MAC exhibit has a ton of really cool audio artifacts and sort of a jukebox interactive where you can play songs like this one by Ron Allen.
If I leave my home, I die in a week. This mountain's where I buried my wife. I've got plenty of booze and there's fish in the creek. I'm staying here the rest of my life. Oh, Harry Truman, your Spirit Lake is gone.
I admit, when I was playing this song a couple days ago, I got kind of choked up listening to that song. Because, again, just a mythic guy. And I knew there were professional musicians making novelty songs. There were journalists interviewing people like Harry Truman and regular people taking photos of the ash cloud. Freya Liggett told me about one unusual case that involved a mom and three kids from Seattle driving in their car between Moses Lake and Spokane as that monstrous ash cloud turned the day to darkness in eastern Washington.
Kids had a cassette recorder with them, so they were recording the radio reports and... I remember doing this as a kid. You just kind of recorded not just what was on the radio, but your conversations. And he found that, I think, shortly after his mother passed away.
So we have a sample of what those kids, and one of whom was actually Chris Ballou, who would grow up to become a member of Presidents of the United States and is now Casper Baby Pants. Here's some of what they captured on their tape recorder from Spokane Valley radio station KZUN.
I just went outside and took a look at my car. And it's starting to fall right now. The ash is starting to fall out here in the valley, just very lightly, just little bitty, teeny specks. Looks like puffed up grains of sand, only it's black. And the cloud is now really moving into the valley, and you can, if you look out your window there, you can see it. You want to stay inside, though, because there are caustic chemicals in that ash, and we don't know how intense they are. Once they reach us, they've gone a few miles and may have the chemicals may have dissipated a little bit, but you want to be safe. You always want to be safe, so stay inside and just Have yourself a good day. Stay tuned into KZUN. We'll keep you up to date.
This is the fastest day I've ever seen.
Just now hearing that reminds me of Fire Sign Theater. I don't know if you ever listened to that in the 70s. Anyway, I hadn't been able to identify the announcers who were on the air that day, but I find this kind of live and local radio coverage of breaking news to be unsurpassed for understanding the mood of a particular time. The newspaper clippings, even people's personal stories, don't do this as well as radio. Of course, I'm biased about that.
Yes.
Here's another clip from KZUN from May 18th, 1980.
Just had a call from a lady who said, what's going on? She was fishing at Moon Lake. They were driving into Spokane, didn't have the radio on, and this, so we better bring people up to date.
Yeah.
In case they just did tune in or coming in from a camping trip. This, of course, is volcanic ash falling from Mount St. Helens and caused the darkness if you didn't have your radio on or were watching television or whatever. And this is the result of the darkness. Also, had a report from Fairchild Air Force Base. A man was unpacking his camping gear and walking in toward the wind. So he says, do not do that, because his eye is full of ash. So this is volcanic ash falling from Mount St. Helens, causing the darkness here in Spokane areas.
Yeah, so I was tuned to Cairo Radio all day back in 1980. I didn't make any recordings of it, or if I did, I lost them. If there's anyone listening this morning who has tapes from Cairo, we would love to hear them, because we're going to do more stories about this as the as we get closer to the anniversary of the first eruption in late March and the big cataclysmic eruption at the end of May. So.
Yeah,
that's lots to come on that. And we have a link to at our website to where they're collecting memories for this exhibit in Spokane, because they want to hear from everybody all over the state. So.
Now, yesterday you were at the Federal Archives at
yes.
Sam Point, where there was a meeting with some of the tribes. What happened?
Well, you know, a bunch of media people showed up, about members from about 10 different tribes came. There were people from the National Office of the National Archives and Records Administration, and they wouldn't go on the record about anything. Nobody would actually talk to me on tape. They're trying to do a reset. They're trying to say, like, hey, okay, the decision's been made. How do we work together with you tribes to identify what your needs are to have access to this material? Because, again, the tribe's material is unique. There's stuff going back to the 1840s, mm-hmm. 1850s, relating to the creation of these.
The newspaper said there are treaties there.
The treaties themselves are actually stored back at the National Archives in College Park, Maryland. Huh. There's stuff that's sort of the next step down from treaties, the actual implementation of the treaties, or the failed implementation, because yeah. the federal government, kind of ironically, made lots of promises to Native tribes that they didn't follow through on.
Yeah.
And a lot of the Natives I talked to yesterday said this is just like that. It's just a sort of the National Archives, they're trying to do a reset, but they haven't quite figured out about how to be transparent, how to share, and show the public that they're trying to act in good faith, where the process the last few months has been so messed up. There's a real lack of trust from the tribes to the archives now.
Well, the vibe I got from the Times article this morning is that the decision's been made, and it doesn't matter how many meetings you call with the tribes, the records are leaving.
Yeah, and that's why most of the people there are looking toward Attorney General Bob Ferguson, who's thinking about legal action, who's submitted all those document requests. Also, to Secretary of State Kim Wyman, who wants to come up with some kind of alternative. It's a very complicated problem with multiple agencies, multiple entities, levels of government involved, and some kind of solution. I'm confident something will be found, but it might end up being a lawsuit before we get any kind of actual positive
solution. So where does your crusade stand at this point?
I'm all about the truth, you know, and transparency in the American way, as you know. So I'm just working on keeping the story alive and letting people know what's going on, because until the agencies involved figure out what it means to actually have a public process, we have to just work extra hard to get updates on the basic information about what we should know about everything that belongs to all of us, Dave.
All right. Felix Bunnell, who is our artifactivist. Our activist.
I like that.
Historian.
I like that better than postivist. That sounds like a, spaghetti thing.
Pastivist. It's
no,
pastivist.
It sounds too starchy for me.
Well, be safe out there.
Thanks.
This is Seattle's Morning News. Dave Ross with Colleen O'Brien. There is a reason that Bernie Sanders still has a lot of support, despite all the attempts of the president to discount socialism as an economic philosophy, and it's because of millennials. Derek Thompson writes about this in The Atlantic in a piece called How Capitalism Broke Young Adulthood. So it sounds like, and I'm a baby boomer, capitalism worked great for me, but what you're saying is my kids are not convinced. So lead us through the thinking that you talk about in your piece.
Sure. It's interesting because, you know, 10 years ago, capitalism was more popular among millennials and Gen Z than it was among your generation, the baby boomer generation. But something has happened in the last 10 years. And I think it really starts with the Great Recession and the aftermath of the Great Recession, which was really bungled, and the elevated unemployment rate and slow wage growth has particularly stung young people who've had a really hard time starting their young adult lives. That means not only have they graduated from college with high student debt, they've also had a hard time making enough money to pay for essentials like medical coverage or childcare, And then really importantly, housing is one of the important ways that boomers have built wealth in this country. And the housing market has largely been closed to millennials. Millennial home ownership is about a third lower than it was for previous generations. Housing is really expensive across the country. And so I think there's this sense among this generation of 85 million people that the system that exists, the status quo, has failed them, and they need something else. Bernie Sanders is out there offering a compelling something else, and that's why I think they are reaching for his message.
But you also argue that baby boomers who oppose Bernie Sanders' brand of socialism are being hypocrites because they benefit from socialism.
Right. Let's say, so it's interesting because right now, if you ask Democrats under 35 and over 65 who they support, a lot of them support Joe Biden over 65, but they really dislike Bernie Sanders. And then under 35, about 50% of them support Bernie Sanders compared to 5% who support Joe Biden. So there's a huge generational split here. And I think that it's interesting, even ironic or oxymoronical, because you have a lot of these older Democratic voters who are extremely anti-socialism, but they live, as I write, in a world that is actually somewhat socialist. The federal government already guarantees single-payer health care to Americans over 65. That
right.
system is called Medicare, and it's very popular and successful. Senior citizens also receive an income subsidy called Social Security, which is literally socialism. And then while elderly Americans, I think, are often very critical of the idea that the federal government would subsidize student loans for young people or even pay back, you know, hundreds of billions of dollars of student loans to people, say, under the age of 40, they are beneficiaries of this other policy of government debt subsidy called the mortgage interest deduction. The average American homeowner is 55 years old, and the federal government every single decade gives back homeowners $800 billion in taxes paid by giving them the mortgage interest back through the tax code. So the economist Ed Glaser, who's an older economist, has likened these policies to boomer socialism.
Mm-hmm.
And I wanted to write this piece to essentially say, look, boomer socialism exists. Maybe we should be a little bit more generous in allowing for the possibility that some form of Bernie socialism could help as well.
Yeah, and I'm sure that there would be some people my age who would chafe at your definition of Social Security as socialism because they think they paid into it. But really, your Social Security money is coming from people who are currently working and sending it to you. So basically, it's your kids who are paying your Social Security out of their
right.
Payroll tax.
Yeah, there's a lot of definitions of socialism, and this is an issue where, you know, we don't need to go too far down the definition path. But the brand of socialism to which I find most appealing is what's sometimes called social democracy.
Mm-hmm.
This is the kind of socialism that you can see in Scandinavia, in Denmark, in Sweden, in Norway. And, you know, social democracy doesn't mean free money. It means you have the government taking responsibility of more essentials, of more income redistribution, and of a larger share of the economy. And so to essentially have a system by which almost every single American is paying into it over the course of their working life to guarantee a nationalized retirement program, you know, that is social democracy. That is, to a certain extent, socialism. And it is also, without question, one of the most popular programs in the history of the United States. So I just think it's important when people criticize socialism, at least this definition of it, that they stop and ask themselves, do I like or dislike the socialist policies that already exist, like, say, Medicare or Social Security, or, say, you know, the government paying for K-12 education at the public school level? These things do tend to be somewhat popular, and the question therefore becomes, are there other necessities of a modern adult life that we think should also be provided for or guaranteed by the government, like, say, health care for people under the age of 65. That, I think, is where the Bernie Sanders argument is strongest, precisely because it's so difficult for those over 65 to argue that their socialized health care doesn't work.
Well, that's a good strategy. So, since this article appeared in The Atlantic, what were the comments like? Did you trigger any baby boomers?
You know, what was interesting interesting is that I wrote this article not to trigger baby boomers and certainly not to trigger Bernie supporters, because I don't actually consider myself as deep and strong a Bernie supporter as a lot of other people that I know online, but rather to do a good faith representation of the Bernie Sanders argument for people that might not agree with him. I think it's really interesting how unpopular Bernie Sanders is among Americans over the age of 50. Even Americans over the age of 50 who consider themselves Democrats, a party which Bernie Sanders is now the plurality favorite to win the nomination of. So if Bernie Sanders is has a good chance of being the nominee for the Democratic Party, I want older Democrats to understand exactly what he stands for and what the economic circumstances are of millennials who would support him. And that's what this piece was about. It was to say, look, in the 20th century, we decided as a country that modern American capitalism, as it exists, had broken the process of growing old. And so we created Social Security, and we created Medicare, and we created Medicaid. And the poverty rate for senior citizens in this country plummeted from about 50% to less than 10%, and their insurance was practically guaranteed. It was a huge win. I'm saying that the same way that modern American capitalism might have broken the process of growing old, it might be breaking the process of growing up. And we should be open to the possibility that the same way that social democracy paved a way for a better old age in America, that social democracy might too be able to pave a way for a better young adulthood.
Derek Thompson wrote How Capitalism Broke Young Adulthood. It's in The Atlantic. Derek, thanks.
Thank you so much.
It's time for your daily dose of kindness, sponsored by Mike Novak and listwithnovak.com. A couple of New York deli owners have come up with a unique way to provide free food for their customers. One of the owners has asked his customers to do math problems. Then, if they get it right, they have 5 seconds to grab what they want. The first video went viral because his customer tried to grab his cat.
OT, 10 times 10 minus 50.
50.
5. 4. Now my cat. 3.
So the cat is the only thing off limits at the deli. Customers have walked out of the store with Bluetooth speakers, bananas, loaves of bread. Ahmed Alwan says he just wants to help people. Most of his customers are low income. Now, while some might criticize Alwan for taking videos of his needier customers, he'll push back at that. He's built a relationship with them. This is New York, after all. He knows them well. Everyone's having fun. And it's the fun that's drawing so many people to these videos, which is ultimately about generosity.
Anissa, 11 times 11 minus 20.
11 times 11, 121 minus 101.
5, 4, 3.
Okay. It's fun to watch. It's a little like Supermarket Sweep, one of my favorite TV games. Alwan pays for the items with his own money. He says the simple act of generosity is impacting the business in a big way, spreading positivity throughout the community. You can hear the laughter in this video.
If you have 10 apples.
10 apples.
Minus 4 oranges.
Minus 4 oranges.
How much apples does that leave you with?
10 apples minus 4 oranges. I have 10 apples left.
5. 4. 3. 2.
His customers are getting smart, too. In this video, the man grabs a pallet so that he can fit more on top of the pallet instead of just putting all the items in his arm. So it's fun to watch. You can't help but smile when you're seeing this. You feel the community. You love the generosity. Alwan is now accepting GoFundMe donations through a personal crowdfunding page so he can continue to do this. Again, he pays for it all out of his own pocket. But these videos, which are on TikTok, are just a blast to watch. Not all, and not to mention challenge yourself, too, to refresh on some math,
Derivative of 2x squared minus 2.
Stop.
5. 4. Here he is, straight from the Gian Ursula bullpen. G. Scott.
Pitchers and catchers, that's why he brought that up.
Yeah. The pitchers and catchers report today for the Mariners. It seems like just yesterday that the season ended.
Yeah, you got high expectations, Dave?
I have high expectations, but you know who has really high expectations? This person right here.
Colleen does?
Why'd you laugh first? No matter what. I don't know. It just, it always makes me chuckle whenever I become the center of a sports story. But the Mariners were my childhood team, and I'm sticking with them. And you know what? I can put a positive spin on anything for the Mariners. Some might say that they're still the only team who hasn't been to the World Series. Well, guess how sweet that World Series win is going to be when we finally get there. You know?
Mm-hmm.
I'm excited for it.
Yeah.
My kids are like, really? They were good? Because they weren't born yet.
Oh, yes, they were so good.
The When's that World Series win coming, by the way, Colleen?
This year. This year. We're going to do it.
Jeez, you guys are harsh.
You know what? The power of positivity and say, put it out into the universe, it will come back to you.
You just came off one of your stories.
Oh, that's true. My daily dose of kindness.
Yeah.
Got lots of those for the Mariners. Yeah.
What's up, Dave?
Well, I just wanted to hear from you what you think they would need to do to create some interest this year.
When? We talked about this yesterday, remember? I remember that I talked about the fact that here in the Seattle area, there's so many things to do.
People want to win.
People want to go hiking. They want to go do all those things. You know, go see the art museum, the opera as you go and see Dave. They need to win, and they'll come. There is nothing better. I'll say this. Back in 2001, when the Mariners were rolling and it was rocking and they won 116 games and it was 46,000, 47,000 at Safeco Field. The All-Star game was at Safeco Field that summer. That was an amazing summer because, boy, when baseball is good in your city in the summer, there's nothing better. And look, yes, it's a football town now, and back then it was not a football town. It was a baseball town during that time. And I have to say, it's a lot more fun. Downtown Seattle is a lot more fun. Come on now, it's summertime. You being out at the ballpark, it was the best. So I look forward to the time that the Mariners are good again. That will be great, fantastic. Even though they haven't been good, it's still good to go down there and get a couple games.
It's interesting, though, because even when the Seahawks are losing a few games, or even when, you know, heading into the Seahawks season, I remember talking to you saying, hey, they're making us make predictions about this season. I know nothing. And, you know, you gave me some honest opinions about the Seahawks. You're still able to remain positive and a big fan and support the team, even when things aren't looking good for the Seahawks. Why can't you do the same for the Mariners?
Hey, well, it's been a long time since it hasn't been looking good for the Seahawks. They've been rolling. I think the expectations for the Mariners, right? Like it's just not there. It's not high anymore. It's been 18 seasons, 18 years since the Mariners have been to the playoffs. So I don't think it's not about the support, because again, if it was about non-support, then if once they start rolling again, or I wouldn't go to the games, or I still do go to a few games during the season. Right?
So if they're if they surprise you this year and they are really good, you're
instead of going to four games in a season, I might go to 15.
Okay,
you know what I mean? Or instead of watching one game during the season on TV, I might watch 30. I mean, there's 160 some games in the season.
Let me ask you this: should the MLB go to a parity system the way the NFL has?
Yes, they need to change it.
The main problem of baseball is there are some teams that you know are never going to win. I mean, that's what it boils down to.
And this is right now, MLB doesn't have the stars like it used to, right?
Correct.
If you guys remember, I mean, look, when
they got rid of the steroids, so.
Jeez, Dave. growing up in Chicago, I used to take my hat, put it backwards, right, and imitate a famous baseball player that was here by the name of whom?
Ken Griffey.
Yeah.
Sure.
There were stars in baseball.
We had personalities. Talk
to them.
At that time, G, you know what I was doing?
Look.
I was watching games at Wrigley Field from my TV in Portland, imitating Ryne Sandberg. And the Hawk.
Right,
I mean,
you know about the Cubs?
Yes. So I was doing the same thing. You're right. There's no star power anymore.
There's not any star power.
So it's a PR problem.
I don't know. If I knew the problem, I'd go try to get a job.
Because I guarantee there are stars. They're just not being sold as such. They're not being marketed to fans.
I'll ask you.
I've argued for the last, 6 years here on Seattle's Morning News that there is no marketing or not effective marketing or PR around the stars that we do have. If you can generate excitement around personalities like we did with Richard Sherman, like we did with Marshawn Lynch, like we have with Russell Wilson, the Mariners would have more people coming because they root for the person, not the team.
Absolutely. And so even you also root for other teams or other players coming into that. And by the way, there are those who are not casual fans. Like I think that I'm a casual baseball fan, right? And what I mean by a casual fan is like I don't know all the stats and know all every single player used to when I was younger. I'm talking about the casual fan. And the casual fan, that's the majority of fans with either any sport. In baseball right now, Colleen, can any of you guys tell us the top three stars in baseball today, in MLB. If you do know, great. If you don't know, probably not like me.
Dave Ross.
But years ago, years ago, you had stars in baseball.
Yeah. Mickey Mantle, Whitey Ford.
Oh, gosh.
It's Bobby Richardson.
So it's a PR marketing issue. And I think I just talked the Mariners into hiring me for PR and marketing.
Mm-hmm. You would leave Dave Ross's side?
No, I would do
baseball's also a somewhat dying sport at the young end, too. So.
We'll get back to that later. G. Scott, 9 o'clock. G. and Ursula right here on Cairo Radio. Thanks, G. We go to New Hampshire, CBS News White House correspondent. Stephen Portnoy has broken the bonds of the Beltway and now is at the temporary center of the electoral universe, that being New Hampshire. I want to know crowd size. Who has drawn the biggest crowds over the past week in New Hampshire, Stephen?
Well, the biggest crowd was drawn by President Trump, and that was at a rally on Monday when he had more than 11,000 people at the Southern New Hampshire University Arena in downtown Manchester. But among the Democrats, but Bernie Sanders in a pre-election rally on Monday night had about 7,500. That's what we were told. I was with the president.
So Trump is still drawing the biggest crowds then?
That's correct. Now remember, the Democrats have a crowded field. So there are many options if you are a Democrat. You can choose from several different candidates you want to go to. But what no candidate on the Democratic side has been able to do is amass the size crowds that President Trump consistently draws wherever he goes, anywhere in the country. And that is formidable.
Okay. You were hanging out with Buttigieg. How big are his crowds?
Well, he had a capacity crowd last night at a rather small venue, about 1,200 people, at a community college gym in Nashua. And it was full, and there were reports that there were people outside who couldn't get in. But 1,200 people is a decent-sized election night rally crowd, but not exactly people waiting in line for miles and days to get in.
Yeah, okay. See, that to me, that's the – I had never seen crowds as big as Trump's 4 years ago when you and I met and were covering New Hampshire together. And that seems to be really significant. I know people said back then, that doesn't matter. It's just because, you know, he's a curiosity. Well, they were wrong. I mean, the crowds did count for something. Yeah. And even though Buttigieg comes in as a close second to Sanders, you're telling me the crowds really are not even the same order of magnitude.
No, that's fair to say. What is interesting is even though Sanders draws the largest crowds so far on the Democratic side, here in New Hampshire, he was basically toe-to-toe with Buttigieg. I mean, Sanders eked out 1.5 percentage points more than Buttigieg. And what's also interesting, and you've been talking about this all morning, is Amy Klobuchar coming a strong third with about 20% of the vote. Mm-hmm. And if you take the enthusiasm that Bernie Sanders continues to enjoy and the support he continues to draw on the progressive left, and you balance it against the support that the moderates in the race now have, Sanders is significantly outweighed with the support that the moderates are enjoying. The problem for the moderates is their votes are split. And the question going forward is, you know, how much longer will the split remain? You know, and what's the impact of Mike Bloomberg in this race? And where does Joe Biden go from here, having placed fifth in the New Hampshire primary?
Yeah, well, he thinks South Carolina is going to bail him out. I don't know about that. Do you who do the non-Sanders people go to in the general election? Because I remember back at 4 years ago, Sanders and Trump were actually trading supporters. I mean, you could see people who were clear trying to decide between both of them. But this time around, the people who are not, the Democrats who are not going to Sanders, where do they go?
Well, the Democrats who are not going to Sanders have a few choices, right? And they can choose between, at this moment, Pete Buttigieg, Amy Klobuchar, still Elizabeth Warren's in the race. She came in fourth year, Joe Biden in fifth. And those are the primary choices that people are thinking about. Now, the big, as I say, X factor is Michael Bloomberg, who was not on the ballot here in New Hampshire. And in election, in polls that have been taken, Bloomberg is now achieving double digits in national surveys, which indicates that in the Super Tuesday states, in which he hopes to do well in about 2.5 weeks, 3 weeks or so, there's the potential for him to significantly alter the current dynamics of the race. And, you know, who's up, who's down if Bloomberg is present is still an open question. I don't expect him to be much of a factor in South Carolina. I'm not even sure he's on the ballot.
But I'm trying to think. Bloomberg can't possibly draw from Sanders, right? Because they are anti-billionaire.
No.
So he basically sucks away everybody else's support on the Democratic side, right?
Right. So you look at the people who are interested in Mike Bloomberg, people who are dissatisfied by the other moderates, right? People who believe, who may be inspired by Pete Buttigieg, but think he's probably inexperienced and isn't perhaps the right candidate to go up against President Trump. People are taking to Amy Klobuchar. They certainly did here in New Hampshire because of her strong debate performance last Friday. Is that the kind of thing that has staying power, right? Will Amy Klobuchar's new fans stay with her, or is she sort of, the flavor of the week? We've seen that, where people have their moments, and they go up in the polls and then go down. In this case, what polls did show and predict was a surge in support for Amy Klobuchar in the lead up to, in the final days leading up to this New Hampshire primary. And what was also fascinating to look at our network exit polls last night was the fact that half of New Hampshire's Democratic electorate said they only made up their mind in the last few days.
Yeah.
A significant advantage for Amy Klobuchar that she had a strong night in the debate. The Bernie Sanders base is baked in and long lasting. It is an enduring base of support that is built over the last several years that he's been on the scene.
Stephen Portnoy, live in New Hampshire. Thanks, Stephen.
You bet.
So we have card tab relief, a low carbon fuel standard, prolific offenders, homelessness, repeat DUI offenders, the death penalty, bans on so-called assault weapons and high-capacity magazines, and which one of those are surviving?
So it's a mixed bag. Yesterday was a key cutoff period, and there are 1,700 or so bills still alive. I won't get to them all, obviously, in the next few minutes, but we'll start with guns. There were several gun safety proposals once again this session, the biggies, proposals to ban so-called assault weapons and high-capacity magazines. Once again, though, it looks like there just wasn't the support to get the ban on assault weapons across the finish line. That's out.
All right.
But the proposed high-capacity magazine ban is still alive. It has a chance moving forward. It remains to be seen. There's some disagreement over whether that should be a ban on magazines holding 10 or more rounds or 15 or more rounds.
Now, the guy who shot up the street downtown had just before that purchased a high-capacity magazine, correct?
That is right, one that would fall under that definition. Yeah. Other gun proposals still in the mix include a centralized background check policy, tougher penalties for some gun crimes, and the creation of the new Office of Firearm Violence Prevention that will, among other things, gather data that can help individual communities figure out the best way to prevent gun violence in their areas. This Seattle community activist explained to lawmakers why this can help.
Through my violence prevention work in Seattle, I've seen how effective holistic and community-based programs can be in reducing violence. Research on similar programs in cities like Oakland and Milwaukee and New York have found the same to be true. Empowering the communities that know what the crisis looks like best will help them lead the fight against gun violence. It'll make our community safer.
And as I understand this, this is not going after just the weapons themselves. This is trying to make sure they don't get into the wrong hands, right?
Research. We do some of that here in King County and Seattle already. This would be a statewide effort, which is a very big deal. Has a lot of support. Republicans pretty much saying that they think this is another gun control informative effort. So we'll see how it goes. Other bills still moving forward include some new laws on fentanyl, job training for homeless folks, a low-carbon fuel standard is still on the table. A bunch of bills aimed at increasing affordable housing stock also moving ahead, including a density bill that requires most cities and counties planning under the Growth Management Act to allow duplexes, triplexes, and quadplexes to be built in areas currently zoned for single-family homes.
They could override Seattle's local zoning?
Yes. Another bill would mandate or encourage cities and counties to enact policies for accessory dwelling units so that everybody has a policy. They wouldn't necessarily have to allow them, but they'd have to have a policy. Democratic Representative Joe Fitzgibbon is behind this proposal.
This is one policy that allows property owners more rights for what they can do with their property in terms of allowing additional residents to utilize their land and to find a home.
So there are multiple other bills that do a lot of very technical stuff that are, you always ask me, is there anybody helping to build more and make sure there's more housing? There is a ton of those, and they are all moving forward at this point. There are other things that are still alive where the proposed
abolishment of the death penalty. That is still on the table. Mandatory sex education for all kids in public schools, still on the table. And then also still moving is the crackdown on repeat DUI offenders. We've talked about this for a couple of years. It extends that look back period. So if you've got to 15 years, right, so that you'll be charged with a felony if you get fourth DUI in 15 years.
15 years.
Yeah. So that one didn't quite make it out last year, so it's still moving right now, and there's some excitement there. As many of the bills that did pass, there are many others that are now considered dead. Among those not making the cut this year, Senator Steve O'Bann's Trexit bill, that was the one that would allow Pierce County to exit Sound Transit's taxing district, Brexit style, when it comes to light rail projects like ST3. Another one that I thought might have gone a little further that didn't make it was O'Bann's guardianship bill targeting prolific offenders. It was the one that would have allowed repeat offenders with drug or mental health issues to be forced into treatment after, you know, those folks that we see, especially here in the Seattle streets, who refuse treatment because they don't think that they need it. There was the woman who testified in that hearing whose son had taken his own life just last year after because his mental condition made him believe there was nothing wrong with him. And so there was a lot of effort trying to push for that to get passed, but it did not make the cutoff.
But red flag laws are still in effect, right? So, I mean, there's still an option for disarming people who are dangerous, correct?
Yes, absolutely. We have our ERPO laws are on the books. This had nothing to do with guns. This was about those, you know, repeat.
This is actually committing a whole, the person to treatment against their will.
Yeah, whether that be drug treatment or some sort of mental health counseling.
I thought we still had a provision, the Cafe Eraser legislation, which allowed family members to commit people, no?
Yeah, but this is a lower level of crime we're talking about, okay? We're talking about people who are picked up for misdemeanors multiple times, cycling in and out of the jails, not with a weapon involved or anything like that, not necessarily for assault or anything that would rise to that level, but who are just, you know.
So is that it then for dealing with the prolific offender problem, which the, you know, Seattle Downtown Association had raised? That's it for this year?
That was the big one. There was another guardianship bill that's not quite as extensive. And there's more discussions. And, you know, just we're halfway through the session. Anything can still be proposed at the moment. So I wouldn't say that there's not going to be anything done. Gas ban. We just talked about it yesterday or the day before. The ban on gas cars starting in 2030.
Yeah.
It's gone. Off the table for
not popular, huh?
Shucks.
There was a lot of discussion to be had. And I haven't had a chance to talk with Representative Macri since it died last night. To see what her take was. But in listening to the hearings, there was a lot of questions, and it's a short session, and I think maybe anyone who was behind it thought it might need more work.
Discussion is fine. I thought a forced 10-year deadline to get it figured out seemed a little tight to me. But I think we should discuss it. But, yeah, just 10 years seemed way too tight to pull that off.
No way that's the last we've heard of it, I'll tell you that.
Yeah, but, I mean, I think the market's going to overtake this
issue.
Eventually, electric cars, because the maintenance on electric cars is pretty much zero. You never need new brakes. You never need engine maintenance. You don't even need to get a lube job. The problem is the battery technology and the time it takes to charge them. And once they fix that, I don't know who would want to buy a gas car after that.
Right. And all of those questions were questions that came up. Yeah. And you know, did we have the infrastructure to make that happen by that date? Other thing that I want to point out that is still alive, I was surprised to see, is that Senator Fortunato has a proposal that would ban things like the Shama Sawant tax Amazon, or I'm sorry, the winter evictions from Shama Sawant. So we just passed at the Seattle City Council the ban on winter evictions.
Right.
His bill, should it be moved forward and get a vote, would cancel that out, basically, would block it.
So cities would not have that kind of local control on.
Yes, they wouldn't be able to ban evictions of any kind.
Right. You missed the biggest one.
Car tabs.
No. How are we on the state clam?
Oh, I do believe
Let's not forget they do vital things down there. Let's not forget the razor clam is due to become the state clam.
Is that
right?
Still alive?
I believe so. I did not check this morning.
That?
I meant to look for you, Sully. I'm so sorry. I forgot. I'll check, though, and I'll give you an update.
Because, the gooey duck's still the state bivalve.
It is.
And this, the razor clam would be the
I
state clam.
I still don't get the difference, but okay, fine. Is that a good thing, by the way, when they declare a state thing? Because doesn't that mean just more people go out and harvest them for dinner?
I'm gonna ask Sully on that one.
I don't know. I just think it's fun. You know, we have a state aquatic mammals. We've got state bivalves. We've got state single-celled organisms.
Every session, he gets going with me.
I don't know. It's just,
Right. State rodent, the state destructive
all,
pest.
All of those. Yeah. And as we left it yesterday, the only car tab relief bill that is on the table is the one from Democratic Senator Marco Elias, which is that $40 to $50 off your car tab bill. And that's it.
All right. Hannah Scott, thank you, Hannah.
You bet.
I'm Dave Ross.
And I'm Colleen O'Brien. Thanks for listening to Seattle's Morning News.
You can hear us live every morning on 97.3 FM or subscribe to this podcast and you'll never miss the show.